examples like Linux, Apache, and so on and so forth. They're prototypical distributed, self-organizing, technology-supported teams. They're global teams working around the world, generally outside of an organizational context, although increasingly with participation from corporate employees. Key to our research, supported by the technology, the interactions. Some of the groups do meet face-to-face, but the bulk of the work is actually conducted via interchange such as email. It's important, we think, to understand these teams, as I said, because they are being used in increasing numbers of contexts, but especially the self-organizing ones, which might, for example, come up in the case of an alliance, as was in the previous paper, may not have a single organizational structure that can impose particular practices. May not have strong authority relationships if it's a game, some kind of alliance where people are more equal and have to be convinced to come along. And in the absence of those, we thought it was important to understand how the practices actually evolve and what kinds of shape they take. So the specific research questions that we address in this paper is to ask what kinds of decision-making processes emerge in these self-organizing teams. A specific piece of that is the projects that are positioned as open source actually act in an open source way in terms of decision-making, and also what is the relationship between the decision-making processes and the team effectiveness. We look specifically at group decisions. Our definition of a group decision is a group commitment to a future course of action. And in the case of open source, that would be things like accepting code, which commits the group to having that code as part of the new release, accepting a new member, changing a process which goes on at the group level. So something above an individual decision, something that involves the whole group and results in the group having a commitment to some future action. We did this in the context of a longitudinal multiple embedded case study, and at this point I'm going to turn it over to Jealous to talk about the design of the study.
So we used theoretical sampling to make sure that our projects that we selected are comparable. So they're all hosted on SourceForge, they use the same tools, and they're on the same development stage, so they're comparable. At the same time, we wanted to be able to compare them on the different differences that they have. So we picked three projects from that work on instant messaging clients and three projects from ERP software development teams. And these two groups have different levels of complexity as well as different user bases. IM projects are more towards individual users, whereas the ERP systems are targeting the companies. Our embedded the data we used is email messages from developers' listservs, because these groups use developers' listservs as the main communication tool. Our embedded unit of analysis is decision episodes. So we define decision episodes as a process of developers, admins, and users interactively responding to a trigger. So in this case, we define trigger as any opportunity for decision making that might bind the group as a whole. So when we look at the decision episodes that we selected, we basically see two different types of decision episodes, the more simple ones and the complex ones. The first two are examples of simple ones, and the T's stand for triggers, V stand for discussion, and VA stands for decision announcement. So the first one, where we had a single trigger and then we had some discussion and decision announcement at one point, we call them single trigger, simple decision processes. The second one, where we saw the types where we had multiple triggers in the initial email and then we had bunch of decision announcements about these triggers, and so we followed the discussion throughout to find where the decision announcements were. The last one was, it started with a single trigger or at times multiple triggers, but what we saw was as the discussion went on, there were new triggers being introduced, for example this one, and so there were new decision making processes that got initiated, and these are complex decision making processes. So we coded these episodes based on five different variables, and one of them is decision type. So we separated it with code-related and non-code-related. Code-related are clear. Non-code-related decision episodes included decisions about strategy, about infrastructure, and membership, etc. And then we looked at the trigger types, and we saw that we had people reporting bugs, we had people asking for different features in the software, people reporting problems without knowing whether they're bug or whether they just don't know something. There were pad submissions and list of things to do related to release or not. Just covered this in the previous slide. And now we have three types of decision announcements. One of them was the agreement that there needs to be a code change. And the second one was somebody accepting the code change. And the third one was related to the non-code discussion. So we still need to further analyze the non-code related decision announcement, as well as the decision style. That'll be our next step. Here's an example of an episode coding. So we have four different emails. The first email, the guy says here, now I think it's important to add this field in. So he wants a change in the code. The trigger type would be a feature, a new feature addition. It's a code-related episode, definitely. And it's single trigger, one decision opportunity. And then you see the next guy saying, yes, I agree, it's worth having it. So he actually accepts that there needs to be, there's an acceptance of the need for change. And the last, another person says, we'll make that change. Again, a decision announcement on acceptance for need for change. And the last one, somebody actually checks the change and then says, the change is checked in. So that is a decision announcement again, but this time it's the acceptance of code change. So now we've covered what our episodes are like. Let me show you how we've sampled our episodes. We wanted to look at this longitudinally and to understand how it changed across time. And so we sampled 20 episodes from the beginning of the discussion in SourceForge. So these black boxes show the 20 episodes that we selected. And then we selected last 20 episodes at the time that we started the project. You see them here. And then in the middle, you see we decided to pick a middle part and 20 episodes that are actually around the time of a major release so that we can capture some rich discussion. You see, only in Fire's cases, the ending episode is pretty close to the middle episode, and that's because the discussion started to taper off, and you'll see that Fire is one of our less successful projects. So there wasn't meaningful discussion. In addition to the coding, we captured some descriptive statistics about the length of episode, how long the episode lasted in terms of days, number of participants. And our participants are administrators who are listed in SourceForge as project managers or administrators. We have developers who have access to change the code base, and users who can ask questions, make suggestions, or submit patches, but they cannot check them in themselves to the source code. So I'll just start off the findings section, and I'll talk briefly about the performance measures, and then my friend Ching will continue with the statistical analysis of decision episodes. In terms of performance measures, we saw that there are apparent differences in effectiveness of different projects. We measured this based on Kevin's, James, and Holland's article on PLOS success measures. And this is different from overall IS success because, when you look at IS success, you look at the outputs. You look at, okay, is it completed on time? Is it completed in budget? And do the end users accept it? Whereas in PLOS, it's a community effort. So you look at both inputs and outputs in addition to inputs and processes in addition to outputs. So So when we look at different projects, the game with the green line, you can see that game is the best performing project in terms of male participants, the downloads, the page views, and developer accounts. And then it's followed by AMSN, which is the black line. And then Fire is our least successful project with purple. The next one we have is in the ERP project, our most successful one is Compere, in terms of developer count, in terms of downloads and page views. It's not as clear that it's successful in terms of male participants, but overall we thought it was one of the most successful ones. And then it's followed by OSBiz in yellow and WebERP in red.
Our first two research questions. The first one is what kind of decision-making process emerging in self-organizing teams? And the second one is that open source team act in open source way in terms of decision-making. And our guest analysis is on three parts: intelligence over time, individual projects and comparison across projects. The last one is comparison between IAM and ERP. And first, let me look at how we begin. So generally, like, we look at this for plot, and we find all projects except one, the remove one, they all be similar, but remove one is compared, which is corporate sponsored project. In this case, longer time to generate a less discussion. The main reason is because missing a lot of activities and discussion of the thing. We saw some example like different to another one. Yeah, we like this picture we want to edit, but we saw like more later. So this is the reason. Oh, and this decision, this is a field, so we do a lot of information, but we can still see it. Next, we have down the different between code-related aspects and non-code-related aspects. Because there are different in nature, non-code source is more complicated. Sometimes it's hard to find well if you can run things. So we can see in terms of length of episodes and number of participants per episode. And the number of episodes may attract more people to join and may generate longer discussion. So in this way, we decide to only look at the code-only episodes, and later we will look into the number episode and find out different. So we look at the message density of code-related episodes. Message density means how many messages they generate per day. And we find, again, the blue one, compare some outliers the necessity is pretty low compared to the others. But we also find another two, the purple one and the red one. And they are file and WebERP. And they seem to drop down in the last part. And because these two are less successful projects in terms of our performance analysis, but the others are pretty successful. We look at how many participants per advent for code related and within episode. And again, the compare becomes outlier in this case. Now we want to think to individually and to look at how our different roles involved in the different within episodes. We have three roles, administrator, user, and developer. We find the different roles of administrator involvement. We find a similar pattern across all projects at the beginning. We're very active in the beginning and they become less effective gradually. But in IM project, we're going to hand over to developers. But in ERP, we can hand over to users, which is very interesting because ERP users are being customers. They have enough power and skill and personnel to do anything they want to do according to their business requirements. And then we want to look at people like the opportunities. report, we often say this figure is an actual, and we look at the bar chart, and the blue one means a library and a user. The orange one is called including the administrator and developer, and from who has the X library from the left to right. The left one is 3IM projects, and the right to the right one is ERP projects. And from that, you can see the most successful project to the less successful project. And we find most of projects are driven by periphery rather than core, which is green one. That is driven by core. And we also find this real pattern in ERP projects. The more successful one, as you heard, get more driven by delivery part. And then we have the red number in the right graph, which is changed over time in trigger person. And we find that at the beginning, delivery involvement, but they increase the action in the later part. And we know who triggers the announcement, and we know who wants to know who announced the final decision. So also we have the left graph. This will create a pattern in both kinds of projects. The more the periphery involvement, the periphery announcement more in the later part. And change over time, this is the same pattern. The involvement of delivery increase over time, and I'm doing the final thing, which goes through a phenomenon. The open source is the set of open source depends on how many people contribute to the project is developing.
Thank you. So in summary, it seems that the preliminary evidence from analysis of these six projects provides some support for the observation that has been made, I think, in fact, in a couple of the earlier papers in the conference on open source, but the importance of the user community as an integral part of the development and creation of the software. So the projects that seem to be doing well are ones that over time are bringing in more users as active participants, not just users of the software, but actually people who provide opportunities for decisions and, in fact, in some cases, even resolve the decisions. Similarly, a parent pattern where the more successful projects are doing that more, the less successful ones doing it less. And, in fact, FHIR has been sufficiently troubled in getting contributions and maintaining activity amongst the developers that they're, in fact, in the process of shutting down as a development group. So it's a very nice comparison opportunity. So some of the next steps, as has already been mentioned, is to look at some of the differences between the code and the non-code episodes. Most of the analysis that we've shown so far has looked only at the code episodes, just because they've been a little bit clearer to do the qualitative analysis of. Another important step is to actually look more deeply at decision-making processes and to develop a typology of the different styles. So some of the discussion, as was noted in the slide showing the triggers, some of it can be very linear. You know, someone says, I think we need this feature, and then there's some discussion about it and a decision. There's an interesting pattern where sometimes people say, I think we need this feature, and here it is. And then there's discussion as to whether or not that was the right thing. We're also interested in looking at the possible ways that instead of having a rational kind of process like that, it might be much more of a garbage can. So we're hoping to inductively develop a system. Actually, so given this is a research in progress, if there are work that you know on different decision-making styles and these sorts of group settings that you think we should be referring to, I'd certainly appreciate the citations. And finally, we want to look more at the relationship between decision-making style and project success. Right now, we have only been able to do that with a small number of projects because the coding is incredibly labor-intensive. What you see is basically the reflection of about 8 months' worth of work, actually reading through email messages and coding those. So one of the things I want to conclude by is sort of a plug for some future work, looking at ways to automate aspects of that coding. So what we've been doing is working with a colleague of mine who specializes in natural language processing. The kind of work she does, for example, is taking Wire news articles, providing summaries of those, and building up models to say, you know, who's been talking to whom and what they've been doing. But we've been working with her to do some analyses of the email messages. So the goal is not so much to automate the analysis, although that would be lovely, but to provide support for the human coder. Some of the progress is just tailoring the system for the email data type, which involves lots and lots of work to clean up the data to make it usable for use in an NLP. And there's a bunch of work going on just to get that done. But building on that base then, one of our colleagues, Eileen Allen, has developed a preliminary set of rules to identify the decision announcement. So those are the email messages at the start of a decision episode, at the end of a decision episode where someone says, okay, so it seems like we've decided this. And so the rules that she developed actually go through and they build up, frames like this that have text and some description of what it is. One of the interesting things trying to formalize the rules is you actually have to make distinctions between different kinds of decision announcements, and so that actually sort of feeds back into the coding. Her results so far, though, are quite promising. The system was able to identify, what she did is she ran it on the email messages that had been coded for Fire and Game, and identified the sentences that the human coders had picked up as being decision announcements, and then compared that to the sentences that her system picked up. You can see that her system identified more sentences, meaning it has a low precision. That is to say, not all of the sentences her system identified are ones that the human also identified, but it has quite a high recall. Recall meaning that of the sentences that the human identified as a decision announcement, she was able to find 88% of them. So it's evidence that a system like this could be quite helpful because it only picked out about 4% of the sentences. So that would allow the human, instead of having to read all of the text, to have the system say, here's a number of sentences that look like the decision announcements, and maybe you want to start with that. And in fact, this bottom number is her assessment of how many of those sentences actually probably were usable decision announcements. So in fact, the fact that this usefulness is higher than the precision implies that the system was able to find things that the human coder didn't, that in fact we probably should have been looking at.
How many more minutes do we need?
Perfect. Magic.
So, what we hope to be able to do is to come back at a future date and have used some of this automation and been able to look at dozens, hundreds of projects as opposed to just the six today. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Now let's open for questions.
Well, what percentage of your decisions are non-code?
Out of the 120, so the bulk were code, a small number were non-code. But the non-code are much harder to identify because they're so diverse. So that is, we think that that's reliable, but that's something that's going to have to change.
It seems to me that that's the most interesting thing that, that makes it the most transferable to different types of projects.
Yeah, that's a good observation. There are a lot of the decisions which are going to be specific to the context no matter what. One of the interesting things is that in order to participate in the code decisions, you actually do have to be a coder, whereas discussions about overall strategy and what kinds of feature sets and things like that, it does bring in a broader participation. So I think understanding the difference between those would be important.
Aren't you actually looking at more than just decision making? Because I was looking at some of the quotes that were mentioned, maybe about more than just decision making, unless you're having broad definition. It made me think of SpeechX, actually. Yeah.
The outcome is a decision, but certainly along the way to it, many other things happen. Expressions of, it's a good idea, bad idea. And so, in terms of analyzing the decision process and the style of decision making that the team adopts, I think we are going to have to look more broadly at the different kinds of speech acts. Liz is quite interested in being able to identify emotion in text. She has some students working on that, so that would be something perhaps to apply.
I just wanted to add to that. James Harrison, one of the co-authors. One of the things that we're seeing that's relevant to, say, analyzing email conversation as speech act and turn-taking in it is most of the analysis on decision-making so far has focused on groups in the same room where the turns are, quite rapid between them. But what we see, particularly in the multiple episodes, is that somebody will put down their entire analysis of the problem in one email, and then, you know, a couple of hours or a day later, somebody else comes through with their whole analysis of the problem. So rather than the group moving in a mode, individuals are having a conversation at the group level, but they're also thinking through the issues at an individual level. So it's really a very new type of discussion, different from where we've analyzed decisions before. So yeah, there's more to be done with that.
And in fact, one of the things that complicates both the natural language processing as well as the human coding is, in the cases James mentioned, you may see the second analysis interspersed with the first.
Right.
So someone will take a couple of paragraphs of discussion and then, you know, answer point by point some of the things that the person's raised. So if it were a face-to-face conversation, it might have gone back and forth, you know, I think this, well, what about this, what about this? In this case, it's, you know, stating an entire position and then someone systematically going through and supporting or rebutting it. So what was the turn taking like in that? It's very complicated to actually work out the details, and of course our analysis is still at a fairly broad high level. One of the things I do also want to mention though in relation to that, part of what we're hoping to get out of the comparison between the IAM and the ERP clients is some understanding of the way the knowledge gets mobilized. So part of the problem in the software example with this, drawn from the ERP, is that the requirements for the software are not necessarily broadly shared. You want, for example, to have CompTIA customized so it does invoices for Finland. Well, how many people know what a Finnish invoice is supposed to look like anyway? But unless you can get access to that information and get it into the system, you know, that has to happen somehow for the system to be successful. It's very different from an IAM client, where everyone has an opinion, and everyone's opinion is about as good as anyone else's.
Next question. Can you go to slide 19? Nobody else asked me. I was saying you should. Yeah, this one. Why does the two type of pattern have a different trend in terms of the relationship between developer and user?
Yeah, I think it's exactly what I was saying, that in order to be able to contribute to the ERP projects, you need to be bringing in knowledge about the context in which the system's going to be applied. So those users tend to be, for example, someone who's actually going to deploy it in a particular company and needs to contribute a particular feature to make it useful in that setting. Contrary-wise, with the IAM projects, since the knowledge is very much localized, people who are interested simply become developers and contribute that way. So
does that have to do with the intrinsic complexity of the technology? The ERP system is much more complex.
Right.
Users might have, you know, ERP system is known to be not the user system. On the other hand, IAM system may be a little simpler.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think what you're seeing here is a reflection of that underlying dimension that we were trying to get at with the theoretical sampling.
Right. Shoot back to the logos. I don't know if you noticed, but that exact point, the complexity of the application, is depicted by these logos here. The IAM ones are icons for a computer application. The ERP ones are logos for a corporate organization. And I think that captures that difference between them quite visually.
Right. One is the enterprise application, another a little bit more on the individual.
More an individual level, right.
Exactly.
Simpler requirements.
One thing we've been talking about is the universe of discourse that's embodied in the software. So if you think about an IAM client, what you need to know about an IAM client is the interface to the server and the interface to the user. That's pretty much what that system's about. Whereas for the ERP system, the universe of discourse includes things like invoices and accounting practices and workflows. And
more functional questions.
Right, and as I said, the knowledge about what is needed for that and how it ought to work is not something that's necessarily wide.